Blog Talk Radio. Good evening, and welcome to WSI-sponsored Pagans Tonight Radio Network. Come explore news, information, entertainment, and ideas from a pagan point of view around the globe. Tune in every night for interviews and lively discussions on current events, philosophies, traditional and not-so-traditional practices, DIY projects, the who's who and what's what of our growing pagan community right here on Blog Talk Radio in English and now in Spanish.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you're at in the world today. I could be any one of 202 countries that regularly visit your site. I'm your host, Ed the Pagan Hubbard, along with my illustrious co-conspirator,
Tracy Logan Wood. Welcome to the show, everybody.
And we are here on another Find Wild Wednesday. Hump Day, I guess you'd call it.
Pagan Hump Day. Pagans Tonight Hump Day.
That's it. And so we thank everybody out there. If you are listening live at pagastonight.com, would you do me a favor? Hit your Twitter, hit your Facebook, and let people know we've gone on live. We're going to have a really great show tonight, 2 hours of really interesting guests. So where do we begin today?
News.
I think the most interesting news, and it's getting mixed reactions out there, is the announcement by the world's largest auction online site, eBay, has announced that it was going to discontinue a lot of categories so people can charge in, including magic, psychic readings, advice, a number of spells, literally spells, and some other items of similar nature. They're, you know, you're not going to be able to sell readings through eBay. Actually, and we've sold a lot of readings through eBay. But also, I'm looking at it, and more and more I'm looking at it. It looks, I think I have an idea what they're going to do, but some of the items were pretty amazing. And, you know, they were talking about it, and it's, and I was one of the first people to find this out, and so people have been sharing it quite a bit. And, yeah, because somebody was trying to.
I'm really surprised.
Okay, here's what it is. Prohibited items list: advice, spells, curses, hexing, conjuring, magic, prayers, blessing services, magic potions, healing sessions, work from home, business and information, wholesale lists, and drop shop lists. There you go. That's a whole lot of what
they
have.
Okay, those last two, I didn't know what they were.
Wholesale lists?
Oh, drop shop lists.
A drop shop list, shops that will drop things for you if you do so.
Hmm.
Yes. So, yeah, I understand that one.
So, but I am pretty surprised that they decided to just continue all of that stuff, because I figure they're probably making a bundle of money on those listings.
Yeah, I would presume. I would presume the same thing. I would presume the same thing because here's what it is. I think what it is, I would presume the same that they're making money. But if they're running into fraud situations too often,
mm-hmm.
you know, gypsy readers, people who aren't fulfilling readings. I mean, I know for a fact, when Don was doing readings at the World Witches Museum, he missed a number of readings. And ended up having to go through a whole convoluted thing to do refunds. And one of the things that had happened was that, you know, he had to go through PayPal, and PayPal refunded it. If that's happening too often, there's a problem. Or maybe they're just saying that they don't want to be in this business anymore. I don't know.
I don't know that I could say specifically that's the issue, because there's tons of people who have ripped other people off.
Mm-hmm.
Via eBay, not just people who do that. Because I remember my husband ordered some shoes,
mm-hmm.
and he never got the shoes, and eBay refused to refund his money because it wasn't a high enough amount.
Mm-hmm.
But that was several years ago.
Right, and they've gotten a lot better but then. But, you know, I don't know the nature of it. I mean, I'm not absolutely 100% positive on why they're doing it. It is an interesting thing that they're doing. So I just thought it was interesting. Now, some people, it could be that they're becoming more conservative. Maybe they had too many Christian protesters. I mean, people are being pushed. So I'd love to find out more information on it, but that is, was announced today. So I think it's kind of – I think it's interesting. Oh, she did call it. Okay.
Yeah, I figured I'd tell you the secret private texts you're sending me are coming through all garbled and symbols and not actually words, which is why I was like, huh?
Oh, everybody everybody's been saying that lately. The private, something's wrong with the private things. I did it the other day to Blue Fire Witch, and it did not there.
Must
so,
be you.
Okay. But tonight, people tell us about it. Check on pagansonight at gmail.com. Tell us what you think about the fact that eBay canceled this. Should we be talking about
it
more?
And we just figured we would say you can still buy stuff from woodschoolstore.com. You can
certainly
still buy, get readings from Terry Milton and Don Lewis on the Witch School Store. And we're still on Etsy, so.
Okay. And if you're a reader and looking for us to help you promote and want us to help handle some readings, give us a call. We might be interested. Right?
Yep.
Absolutely. But without further ado, I'm going to bring on our very special guest. I've been looking so forward to listening to her all week. We want to welcome Phaedra Bonowitz.
Good evening, all.
Good evening. Phaedra, we are well. How are you?
I'm reasonably well, although we have some not so big things going on for me right now. But
I gotcha. Yeah. So for people who really don't know who you are, can you give us like a quick, who is Phaedra?
I sure will. Well, let's see. I've been a magician and an initiated witch and what have you for over 25 years. I started off in the Chicago community, where I really did a lot of very public ritual work with a group called Panthea. I've lived in various parts of the country, including downstate Illinois and North Carolina and New York State, and did public work in all of those places. I've done a lot of, you know, festival workshops, things like that. At one point, I was the vice president of the National Law Board of CUPS, the Covenant of Unitarian Universalist Pagans. And along the way, I married Isaac Powell. And I was...
And you wrote some books.
I wrote some books. I wrote a lot, a lot of articles published and things. Isaac and I collaborated together on one of the last books that he ever wrote, which was called Real Energy. It came out in 2007, and we co-authored that one. And so that's been kind of been in semi-retirement for a while, but kind of was trying to stay out there and watch what happens with the community and such. And Isaac was always very interested in the organizational and community end of paganism, and I really cut my teeth doing public ritual and working with groups of people. It's something that, even if I'm not real active, you know, at the moment, I keep an eye on that, and I really like to further community in the community, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Well, you just went across country, too. You just moved from New York to North Carolina and then across country.
Yes, all in the last. Less than 2 years. Yeah, I was living in New York with Isaac, and when he passed away, I went back to North Carolina to stay with friends for a while, kind of figure out what I'm doing next. And what I did was I up and traveled back out here to Ashland, Oregon, where I had lived briefly many years ago, and I always wanted to come back to it. And we had hoped we were going to come back out here together. Life didn't work that way. but I'm very happy to be here. It's a beautiful place with a lot of laid-back people, and I just wish that there were more out-and-out pagan people here instead of all New Age people. we're a little edgier than some of the New Age folks, but, you know, we're finding folks, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I guess I hadn't thought about that, but that is true. I guess we are kind of edgy to the New Age people.
Well, it's funny. When I was originally out here, which was way back in 89, I came out here for a six-month thing with and I drove out here with a friend of mine from Chicago. And most of the people who were out here that we were doing this thing with were from California and Hawaii and, you know, some Europeans and such, but it was all pretty New Agey. We were from the Chicago pagan community, you know. And
uh-huh.
We said, yeah, we're New Age with an edge. We're from Chicago. So there's a little more grittiness, I think, to the pagan community, at least from the pagan part of it that I'm part of, a more down-to-earth, more... I want to say grounded, but you know, it's just a little bit different look on things. And it's a little slower finding that kind of community out here.
Mm-hmm.
But having a good time nonetheless. The town is beautiful. The people are wonderful. And that's one of the things, reasons that I wanted to come back, is the people here are just nice. They're really nice.
And you're back on the internet, more or less.
Yeah. I actually had an internet connection when I was in North Carolina. I had to do everything through my phone or drive to a cafe and things like that. Now I have, like, real broadband. It's all very exciting.
And that's important because most people don't realize it, but according to clout.com, which is a website that talks about people's influence inside the whole world,
mm-hmm.
that you're one of the most influential, literally one of the most influential people in the pagan community.
Well, it's social media, and I always find that very, very flattering. What it means to me is that what I talk about is what people are interested in. And when I share links and share about issues and such, it's stuff that really gets people's attention. So I'm really pleased that I'm able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm delighted that people like what I do. So sometimes people ask, well, how do you do it? And it's like, I don't know, but I'm just going to keep doing whatever I'm doing because people seem to like it.
Yeah, because your influence is even greater than Llewellyn's, and which will, you know, we're like right there with you, but your score is 67 for those who are geeky about that.
Are we talking about clout?
Yes.
But, yeah.
Okay. Brendan sent me an invitation to clout, but I haven't gone to go look to see what my influence is.
Right.
Well, it is definitely a geeky thing. Now, the funny thing is, this will make you laugh, is
mm-hmm.
When I drove out here cross country,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to have somebody drive with me. That's a pretty major car ride. I drove from North Carolina to Chicago to the West Coast.
Right.
So I have somebody with me just in case of car problems or something. And also for company, my health hasn't been the greatest, and I wanted to make sure I had somebody to drive if I was, you know, not feeling up to it. And the gal who came with me was Elizabeth Serino, who was living in the Chicago area. I picked her up in Chicago and came out here. And she was here for, 4 hours? And
mm-hmm.
then she was out here, too, because that's how cool this town is. Well, she's on clout. She's on a clout score of, like, 73.
Wow.
Yeah. But we got this clout-heavy household here, you know? It's all about talking about and being what intrigues people and what's interesting to them. And I'm kind of delighted with it. I like to know that what's important to me and what I find interesting really is interesting to other folks, too.
And, well, we talked a lot, but one of the big things I think that you're talking a lot about now, and
mm-hmm.
Well, you're known for, you know, you're known a lot of ways. You've been handling a lot of stuff. But one of the things you're talking a lot about is what we would call institutional development in our community, for a better word. I know. Or the fact that we need groups.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, it's a conversation you and I have had for many, many years. Ed and I, for those who don't know each other from my Chicago days. We'll probably go back a good 20 years or more. And it is very, for example, I was just looking at a blog that Scott Foster posted about what I need from my paganism. And people were invited to leave their comments moderated so there wouldn't be any bickering back and forth, but to just state out what they need. And so much of it was things like, I need to have some place to go inside somebody's living room if it's raining outside. You know, I need to have some way to make things happen that we need to have happen. And at the same time, there was a lot of edginess about, but I don't know if anybody should be in charge. I don't know, you know, if anybody should be given power. I don't know how to do this. So there's this need to have the things that institutions can provide, and a fear of the way that institutionalization will take away power. And I think that it has a lot to do with our experiences of institutions taking away power. It has a lot to do with people who change their lives to seek out alternative religions may be kind of anti-authoritarian and explorers and individuals to begin with. That's certainly been a theory that's been posited a lot in our community. You know, if you're bold enough to leave things and go find something new, you may not be the best play well with others person.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think that there is just that word institution makes people crazy. Now, I get some of my insight from some of the work that was done in the women's spirituality movement way back in the 1970s. And I think that there were a lot of excesses that came from that movement. And if we get a chance, I'd love to talk about like consensus and things like that, but I want to just put that on the burner for the back burner for the moment. But there were also some insights. There's an author that I like to recommend named Rosemary Rafford Reuther. It's R-E-U-C-H-E-R, and a book that she wrote called Woman Church. I'm pretty sure it was in the very early 80s or 70s. And she talks a lot about what we need to create religious community. And what she says is institutionalization, from this line of thought, I don't remember if she expresses this in this book or I'm remembering it from somewhere else, but all an institution is a way to hand things down for the next generation. You have to create some kind of a structure, and the structure allows it to be handed to the next generation. If there's no structure, if there's no institutionalization, then when the first group of creators goes or leaves or dies or whatever, then it's over and it's gone. But if there's a structure, an institution in some way is created, an institutionalization in some way happens, then there can be that natural flow through the generations, whether it's literal age generations or just generations of people moving through the structure. And that's so important. What really strikes me as I look at the way our groups and what have you handle things and grow and end, both grow and end, is you have to remember how fluid a society we are. We don't stay in the same place very long. And look at all the different places that I've lived. And you can either have a situation when somebody like me comes in and does something, and then when I move, for whatever reason, it stops. Or there could be some kind of structure that when I move, there are other people who can, there's a an organized, structured way where people can move into the space that I left empty.
Now, it's interesting that you're bringing this up in a way as far as, you know, institution and institutions of paganism, because we've been talking about almost the exact same thing on the Priestess Show on Fridays, because this month's topic was community perspective. So I was getting all the women to talk about, you know, how they came into the community, what that was like for them, the first rituals they attended, how they saw the community when they came in, how they see it now, and what they see as the future. So one of our priestesses, Rhiannon Breyer, was talking about her group, and she has set it up in such a way that she firmly believes that if she ever leaves, it will go on without, she knows it will go on without her. And we were talking about how nice that would be across the board because of that fluidity. I mean, specifically, we were talking about the messes that other people make in their communities by starting groups and not sustaining them. And when that group breaks up, it refragments more pieces of the community.
Yeah, it's really hard. It's hard to do groups. It's hard to do interpersonal work. It's hard to get everybody to agree on an agenda, for heaven's sake. And I see that a lot in the fragmentation of groups, that where somebody says, I have a group, and people come in, and they don't, every person, let's say you got eight people there, and there's six different versions, I'm going to allow for one with two couples who might actually agree on something, there's like six different versions of what the group is actually supposed to do and actually supposed to look like. As everything that gets that happens, then people are saying, "Oh, but I thought it was going to be blah blah blah. You're doing it wrong." And you want to help with trying. Oh, well, we're going to get together, and we're going to decide what the group's going to be. And I have found that although has a certain kind of a egalitarian appeal to it, it doesn't work as well as saying, guess what? I have this idea, and I want a group that looks like this. So if you want to join a group that looks like this and is going to do this, come join my group. And if you don't want to do these things, gee, you're a great person, but this isn't the group for you.
Yeah, go start another group of stuff that you're interested in and find like-minded people.
Exactly. And I think we've all seen things where people come in and they want to change the group into what they think the group should be. And everyone wants to be nice and things like that, and you wind up with a lot of confusion. You wind up with a lot of people, you know, trying to accommodate different needs that aren't necessarily accommodatable. Now, I first really experienced this when we did Panthea back in the 1980s. Because we were doing a very radical thing at the time. It was a public pagan church at a time when this was, you know, pretty cutting edge. And we would often have people who would want to get involved, and they would come and say, well, you know, you're doing this wrong because a coven should do blah, 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 blah. And we would say, gosh, you're right. Funny thing is, it's not a coven.
It was a church.
It was a
church structure.
It was a church structure. And we said, you know, like, we are very open. We don't have the same kind of coven structure. We cannot provide the services a coven can provide. We cannot provide the experiences a coven can provide, because that's not what we are. And it actually worked pretty well, you know, to hold the boundaries like that. But we did have a lot of people who came through, who passed through the group, because they were looking for something we weren't. And it's not necessarily a failure of the group to not be, how can I say this, to not be...
to live up to everybody's expectations.
Exactly. You can't suit everybody. You
know, I want to stop you here for a minute, because you said a very important thing about people's expectations of groups And we have talked about that in some of the shows that I mentioned with Precess about definitions, because people don't often check to see if their definitions match, because which to one person could be something completely different to another person.
Yeah.
So define what you mean, how you define the difference between coven and church structure for people who are listening in who may have no idea what the difference is.
Good point. I would say that some of this has to do with some simple group dynamic basics that apply to any kind of a group, whether it's a religious group or a business group or what have you. People have different expectations, and you can accomplish different things with a group of 3 to 5 people, 5 to 10 people, 12 to 20 people, 100 to 150 people, 500 people. In each situation, the people, because of simply the number of people there, will often have different expectations, and you can accomplish different things. Now, if you have 5 people and you call a meeting and you say, well, let's, you know, we want to do this thing, so let's all sit here and hash out how we're going to do it. When you call a meeting of 20 people, you can't do that. You're going to have some kind of agenda, because people will accept it. And they'll get antsy and restless and feel like, you know, what do you mean? You called us all here. Don't you have anything planned? If you do a meeting of 150 people and you say, well, we're just going to figure out on the fly what you're doing, what we're going to do, they're going to look at you like, why did you call this meeting and why am I here? So we have certain psychological group dynamic expectations for different size groups, and that affects what we can accomplish. Now, in a case of a coven is at the low end of the numbers, and covens are mythically 13 people, but
or
in
less.
Fact, or less. But in fact, most covens will split, hive off, break into smaller units before they hit that magic number. The average coven in the United States is more like 5 people. 8 to 10 people is a good sized coven. The covens interact very, very deeply and personally. You can, the expression perfect love and perfect trust, that doesn't mean every pagan encounter. That means how you feel when you go into circle with your coven. And that has a lot to do with being able to drop barriers, being able to drop your shielding, being able to allow yourself to open up on a very intimate level. Now, coven-style work can be very intense. You can go very deeply into some magical work. There's a lot of, this is somewhat why it's been likened to the mystery religion, to where you have very intense personal experiences. But it's definitely a small group activity. A coven-type experiences don't work well with larger numbers of people. A congregational model, or, you know, that it can go big, there's some mid-range things in there. But once you get above, like I said, 10 to a dozen people, you got to change your structures just to accommodate the fact that it's really hard to get that kind of intensity and intimacy above a certain number of people. I don't know if it's our sensory overload or what. Some of your listeners may have experiences of going to festivals. Going to festival with 150 people, 300 people, 600 people, 1,000 people. All very different.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first time I ever went to a festival, it was about 300 people. 600 people was a lot. First time I went to one that was 1,000, I was immediately struck by, unlike 300 or 600, I could feel like over the course of the 5 days, I didn't get to know everybody who was there.
Mm-hmm.
There were people who I knew was attending, but I would never even run across them. A festival of 300 people, I felt like at the end of the 3 or 5 days, I have had some sight or interaction with everybody. Okay? So you carry different abilities with different sight groups. So if you want to bring a common agenda and say, I want to have this really intense experience with these 50 people, it's going to be very different. If you go to a festival with 300 people and you have a real intense experience, and then you go to a festival with 1,000 people, you're going to have a different kind of experience.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's important to remember that and to you know, kind of take things for what they actually are. And it doesn't mean that the festival of 1,000 people did something wrong. It means it's a different experience.
Right.
There's some thought in sociology, I guess would be the discipline that would look at this, where the kind of max number of people that we can, a tribal village level number of people, is something in the several hundred range, 300 to 500 people.
Well, there's a thing called the Dunham number, which is 150 people, about the average we hold in our mind.
Yes, that's very, yeah, exactly. And you can get bigger than that, but not a lot without losing the feeling that everybody's part of everything. And a lot of growing groups get hung up around that Dunham number, around that 150, where there's this idea that I really want the group to get bigger, but I don't want anything to change, and I want to know everybody as well as I do at this point.
And well, let me take that to the other extreme. We have the Witch School system, which is a global system with over 200,000 people. And there's dozens and dozens and dozens of little niche groups inside that bigger group. They all feel like they're part of something, but they don't really feel part of something until they're part of, like, a group on crafts or a group on circle casting or something else. They have to find a smaller group within that big group to be a part of anything.
Wow, what's that?
I don't know. I think she's trying to talk and she's not getting through.
I see. So, Phaedra, if you can hear us, I think we're going to take a break and hang up and call you back. And you should put on your tinfoil hat.
Hello?
Yep, I am still here.
Okay,
so we lost Phaedra. So we're going to take a quick break. So I'm going to push some buttons so Ed can recall Phaedra back or let her call back in. So we'll be right back after this. So stick around if you're just tuning in. You are listening to Wild Wednesdays on Pagans Tonight with Ed the Pagan and Tracy Logan Wood. And this is Wild Wednesday, and we are hanging out with Phaedra Bonowitz. So stick around, and we'll be right back.
Radio Network is a nightly podcast on Blog Talk Radio with a variety of shows. Explore news, information, entertainment, and ideas from a pagan point of view around the globe. Join us on Crystal Web Mondays with Ed and Marianne, exploring where crystals, crafts, and psychic powers converge. Followed by Mark Mandrake and Blue Firewitch covering the mystic and pagan world on the path less traveled. On Tuesdays, Surf Crash Study with Selena Fox, followed by Pagan Priest, a panel show with priests from around the nation talking about men's spirituality. On Wild Wednesdays, where anything goes with Ed the Pagan and me, Tracy Logan Wood, followed by Over to Oberon featuring Grey School's headmaster, wizard Oberon Sel Ravenheart, and Green Egg Editrix Ariel Montserrat. On Karelian Thursdays with Terry Power, discussing the nature of the divine, followed by the pagan pundit, Reverend Don Lewis, the chancellor of the Karelian tradition. On Friday, Pagan Priestess, another panel show featuring priestesses from a variety of backgrounds, philosophies, and traditions. On Saturday, Pagans Tonight in Espanol, led by Reverend Lamatic and Yoko, followed by Circle's Pagan Warrior Radio, a show that supports military pagans, friends, and families. On Sunday, variety show with Liz Hamilton, followed by the new show, Pagan Science Radio. Please visit us at www.pagans.com to see show schedules for all shows or friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Pagans Tonight is sponsored in part by WSI International, your online source for pagan, Wiccan, and magical education. Tune in and join us. Thanks and blessed be. Self for releasing blockages. I now release from my deepest self all my fears and limitations.
both known and unknown to me. All things that block me from my goals are gone, are gone, are gone, never to return. I release them. I let them go. I release them. They are gone. They are gone. They are gone. This is my truest will, so I decree. So it is. So I think we're back after that break.
And we are.
Okay, very good.
We're all back. The aliens interrupted things. All right. We've taken a little bit of a break, and then we've talked about it, but I want to get on to a little bit lighter note. Not that I don't think that it is fascinating, but I had a question somebody brought me about you, Phaedra, when I was mentioning Phaedra Bonowitz. And you've been, you've been through our community, and they were asking about women in the community. And and one of the things that was probably being brought up is that there's a lot of question about the older front guard of the pagan community being female. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the, yourself, your Kazon Clark, for example, Z Budapest, Sina Fox. And one of the questions that was brought up to me is, why have not the older women, the elder women, been more predominant in our community? Why does it seem like the men are more dominant sometimes, the older males, such as Isaac and Oberon?
Yeah, you know, if you go back a half a generation before the women that you named, it was a lot of men. Someone just posted on YouTube a Tom Snyder show from, I think, 1975, where it's like a Halloween show, and he's got Isaac and I think it's Itch, definitely Isaac and a couple other people there, and they were doing a show about witches and witchcraft and magic, and all the guests were male. It was really, I think, the feminist movement in the 70s, especially from V. Budapest and Starhawk, who came up with the, really popularized the idea of this being women's religion, that brought the women much more into the forefront. It was kind of, the idea was that the high priestess was more in charge than the priest, high priest, but yet, you know, this idea came from Gardner, who is what? Man. And in a lot of the movements, it was more nominally the high priestess is in charge. I mean, Gardner said the high priestess is in charge, and he also said you should get rid of the high priestess when she's old and make the maiden while she's still young and pretty to be the high priestess, because that's the way it's supposed to be.
Wow.
So I think so. Pardon me. I think some of it had to do with something with society and the dynamics of that. Some it has to do with who gets published. Perhaps understood below the surface agendas, maybe not even aware of publishing companies and publicity and such. So more weight may be given to men than women. Now, certainly, this started to shift immensely around the 70s and 80s. I would say with the publication of Margo Adler and Starhawk and what have you, and a lot of these books came out in expanded editions, from more like self-publishing to actual editions in the 80s and 90s. But, you know, what we do is simply not separated from the general population. And a lot of people don't realize, just in my lifetime, how many amazing changes there have been on the status of women. I was telling someone online about, for example, I remember the first time I got on a bus in Chicago, and the bus driver was a woman. And that was shocking. Everybody stopped and congratulated her. I mean, there was just, because that was just unheard of, that a woman would be driving the bus. Now it's like, who the heck would even think about that? So to some extent, we're dealing with our history of the wide culture relationship with the sexes as much as with individuals. I don't know. It's hard for me to say, you know, a lot of the men who were prominent, like Isaac and stuff, they're prominent because, damn it, they did the work. They did a lot of stuff, and they certainly, you know, deserve whatever accolades or attention that they got. But there's certainly been, you know, as I said, Starhawk and Margo are two that immediately come in mind that have also had great influences on stuff, and that shouldn't be discounted. So it's a lot of the women, perhaps, I think if you go regionally, you'll find a lot of situations where women left a very strong presence and left a big mark. It's just maybe not so much in the national consciousness. But certainly so many of our popular authors have been female.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, now, for example, there's a DJ Conway. Okay?
Uh-huh.
DJ could be a man, but in fact it's a woman. Now, that's a case of where her book started coming out at a time when it was felt that it was the same reason that J.K. Rowling used J.K. Rowling instead of her actual name, because they said boys. She was told boys won't buy books written by a woman.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that.
So, yeah, so there are authors and such like that that have some, you know, ambiguity to their gender identity simply for as a sales thing. But there's just a lot of authors out there and a lot of work that's been done by women. And I think that it's just the shift over time just has a lot to do with just the way the general culture shifts over time to what it gives emphasis to and who gets in the door first and gets the most attention.
And I agree with that. That is important. And I tell people when they have, and getting back to kind of combine two ideas that we've talked about, one about institutionalizing or doing things about getting pagans out there, and the idea that the first through the door things, I tell people all the time, if somebody hasn't done it before, that's a perfect opportunity for you to do it. I do think one of the things we have in a problem in our community is the Me Too-ism. That's one of the things that fractures it. Well, I could do that, and I could do it better than you, instead of going out and doing it.
Our rule of thumb was at Tempeo, but Tempeo had a rotating ritual presenter.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody came after a ritual, and we used to do the new moon, and they would come and have a list of problems of all the things that we did wrong, we'd say, that's great. Guess what? You're on next month's committee.
and I think that's absolutely a great way to go with a group.
Yeah. Because we've
been doing that for a long time with our temple. Because I don't think that I have, like, super ego when it comes to things like that. So we would always try to work with other groups, and we actually have done rituals in the past with Panthea. And I stepped aside and let the priestess from Panthea lead the ritual with Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
So it was somebody from our group and somebody from their group doing the ritual together.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my track record for working with others in the community, was to let them step up, just to do community effort.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things, too, that I don't think it comes down to so much of that there's a right way and a wrong way to do things, as in there is effective ways and ineffective ways.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that you did this wrong, as if what you did didn't freaking work. You know, and if it didn't work, let's come up with some way that it worked.
Right. Well, my perspective is, too, is that I'm a categorizer. I like to put things in nice little boxes and label them. This is this is that. And I find that by, not having that ego and my willingness to learn things from other people, because I learn better by experiencing them doing something, Mm-hmm. And I've learned so much stuff because one of the things that I've talked about on the show is getting trapped in the Wiccan paradigm of only mm-hmm. doing like God and goddess in a ritual. Mm-hmm. And so I need to go out and experience other things because that's not the only way to do it. So I like to go to other people's rituals, not so I can critique it as far as being right or wrong, but as a learning experience to open myself up to remember that my box paradigm is not everybody else's box paradigm, and it helps keep me open.
Well, you know, it's very interesting that you bring that up because that's one of the subtexts and the topics of discussion that I've seen a lot in the last year or so is people saying, well, I would be part of your pagan community, except that everybody thinks that pagan means Wiccan, and what I do doesn't look like a Wiccan circle, and I get told that I'm doing it wrong. And, you know, there's people who are doing some really serious work with Hellesmos and the Romans and even some of the Asatru stuff. They're not necessarily working in a Wiccan format, but they're doing uh-huh. very powerful ritual and religious work. And part of that is to let, I mean, I feel horribly comfortable in the casting circle and the quarters and what have you structure. That's my, how could I put it? That would be, you know, like my sonata form. I do that sonatas really well. But I know there's amazing other stuff being done too. And it's really part of, I'm not real good at creating those other kinds of rituals, but I adore going to them. I mean,
Absolutely.
A lot of eight people do, they don't do anything that really looks like a Wiccan circle, but they do freaking amazing rituals. And I have such admiration for, some of it, it was the ritual structure that Isaac created and promoted and helped them hone. But it's not like a Wiccan circle. And I think that when we leave ourselves open to doing these kinds of amazing experiences, it's pretty wonderful. But, yeah, there's not just one right way to do it. There's, you know, ways that work and ways that don't.
See, I went to an ADF ritual that was done by Chris Sherback, and I got in trouble.
Because?
I was told that I was not allowed to stand across from Chris's partner, Jack, ever again because he signs and so do I. So we were talking across the circle.
Well, that's
I got yelled at my ADF ritual.
That's etiquette. But, you know, my biggest problem is bad ritual. You know, something that's poorly thought out and badly executed. Is worse than any kind of adjustments in form or structure, you know?
I often
remember something that, in a slightly different context, that I heard from another Chicago guy, Phil Nymark, who wrote The Way of the Orisha. He said, all paths are equally valid, but not all paths are equally valuable. So
that is true.
You're free to do whatever the heck you want and go any way you want. But, you know, you're going to get more things accomplished with some things than with others. And that's the way it is. I don't think that's
You know, and we stress regularly on this show that, you know, it's called Pagans Tonight because it's not just about what Wiccans do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really, there's so much room, and I think that's where people, you know, just get kind of angry about whatever, what you were saying as far as, oh, that's not the right way to do it. It has to be done this way. I think there's plenty of room for everyone to, you know, work their magical groove.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the priestesses on the priestess show is not at all Wiccan. And so I'm kind of trying to twist her arm a little bit to write a ritual in her particular family tradition to show other people, you know, okay, let's do a ritual that's not Wiccan in nature at all on the air, you know, for the experience of it, for people who tune into the show who would be like, oh, wow, that's so cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They do a lot of their group work as, like, mystery plays and things like that. So it's not at all, you know, under the same paradigm as, you know, a Wiccan structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's lots of ways to do things effectively and beautifully. There's lots of ways to create meaningful experiences. I have one caution to people is that if you get too quirky, if you're working with a group and your group comes up with some effective ways of doing things that is a little bit different than saying, any way I do it personally is right, and I'm just going to take these things and I'm going to rearrange everything and I'm going to call for the 8 directions or the 22 directions or what have you, and that's fine. And you may get a lot of fulfillment about out it, but it's going to make it really hard for you to integrate with any other people.
This is very true. I have to tell you, there's a ritual that we did that we filmed way back when for harmonic convergence, and it was in 1991. And every time I watch this video of myself, because I was like 18 or 19 in the video, I absolutely cringe. Because I did this Southern Quarter for this ritual, and I just absolutely felt like I had to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a completely all on my own sort of quarter invocation, and I cringe every time Don makes me whip out the video and show it to somebody.
You know, Pedro is in that audience, I think, if I remember right.
I don't know. It's funny because there's just comes to you know, so much of how you structure liturgy. Like if you get people doing the quarters, the way they're presenting the quarters should have some relationship to one another. There should be some agreement in ahead of time, you know, what it's going to be. And the number of times I've done things very ad hoc, and I say, okay, you're going to call air, and however they do it, you know, you guys who are coming after, kind of try to match what you're doing to that. You know, if people are experienced, that's not a problem. But, you know, if one person is going to do it just real quick of, hi, air, there you are, and the next person's going to read a long poem and the next person's going to do a interpretive dance, it doesn't make for a real clean experience. Mm-hmm. If everybody does
If, you know, somebody's doing a very simple one and then somebody else does something, like, crazy elaborate, then it does kind of throw the balance off.
Well, one of my favorite things is I was at a semi-public ritual in North Carolina many years ago, and each person, the people who were going to do the quarters, just came up with the quarter however they were going to do it. They were given free rein, and I'm pretty sure it was water, and the guy comes up and he's going to read it, and then I realized it was like 3 pages long. And, you know, that's,
I think we've all been to that ritual at least once in our lives.
Taught me to make the rule, like, if you have the custom that everybody raises their hand or holds their athame out to that direction,
mm-hmm.
if you start to see people taking their other arm to hold that arm up, your invocation has been too long.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a handy rule of thumb. You know, as soon as you see that, touch to the case. But, you know, some of that has to do with I actually do workshops on ritual participation skills, how to be a good ritual participant. And that's as much as, you know, how to be, like, not cross-talking across the circle, even if you're doing it in sign language, you.
Yeah, I got told.
That's good. But things like, you know, to be able to contribute your energy however you are to the ritual, in a way that enhances what's going on, that it's not all about you, it's all about making it an experience for everybody. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's guilt. It's guilt. It really isn't about, you know, most people don't come to these things naturally. I mean, yes, you have some people who can play the piano by ear, but most people have to take lessons and practice.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that, again, when we talk about leadership and such in the community, I think that, you know, honoring people who have skills and who have taken the time and put in the effort to the develop their skills, you know, that should be honored. And not just to say, well, we're all on the same level and everything that anybody does is the same words and the same thing. That's kind of mean, isn't it? You know? It's that the first grader isn't at the same level as the 12th grader. It's just, you know, as their worth of human beings, certainly. But their experience and education and abilities, no.
Absolutely, that's very true. The priestess of the group did not get to be the priestess of the group overnight.
Yeah,
you know, the priestess of the group studied and learned all the stuff she needed to learn to create that ritual environment.
But I need to stop this part of the conversation. One, we got to have you back on. Absolutely, I love having you on. But we need to know, well, how people can contact you, Phaedra, and what are you doing in the future here? Yeah, we have 4 minutes left. We're almost out of time. Whoa.
Oh, well, they can always contact me through my AOL email address, which is Phaedra, Phaedra, @AOL.com. That's my public email. I also have a Facebook page where you can message me. And there's also a Facebook fan page for Isaac and Phaedra Bonowitz. You can message me. And, I guess my main address is a little too long to give, but if people want to, you know, contact me in any of those things, I'll be happy to give them my mailing address here. I'm currently in Ashland, Oregon. For what I'm doing in the future, it's a little bit up in the air. Facing some real intense medical diagnoses, which I will know more about by the end of the week or so, hopefully. And that's going to kind of cramp my style a little bit.
Well, we'll send you all our prayers.
Yeah, please do, because this is kind of, it's going to be kind of a trip. And I'm not going into details because I don't have final information. It's just a lot of speculation at this point. But it's big for me. And I don't know how my health is going to make me available outside of situations like this for a while. So, I'll be doing what I can and trying to get myself healthy so I can be out there and participating more. And, you know, it's funny, you know, even if I can't do right now, it's like I've seen a lot and I've done a lot and I've been around a lot and I'm more than happy to tell you what I think of what I've seen. And if that's a help to some people and my social media people think it is, then that's what I can do, and that's what I will do.
Well, people have asked, you know, when people have said, who else would you like to see as a host? We always mention Phaedra.
Yeah, but, you know, if that happens, we're hijacking her for priestess.
Okay.
Well, right now, as I say, my health does not let me commit to anything because on any given day, frankly, I never know if I would be well enough to have a conversation like we did tonight. But,
so send lots of good energy to Phaedra so we can have her committed.
That's right.
I mean, get her committed. Sorry, I couldn't resist, Phaedra.
I know exactly what you meant. The first is right there. That's okay. That's why I like my old Chicago bud. You know, we have our ways of talking.
Yes, absolutely. We like to tease and sing drinking songs.
But I have one last question. So you took a cat across country. So how's your cat holding up after this? Your cat became a little bizarre.
Yes, my little black cat named Benny. He is a trooper. I put him in a place in North Carolina, and he was in hotel rooms with me and staying at my sister's and staying at people's houses along the way. And to the point now, it doesn't even like, oh, okay, great. You know, he's a pretty good little traveler. He's not one of these whiners. You know, he does not sit there and cry all the time. He just kind of curls up and takes a nap. And sometimes we put him on a leash and let him walk around in the station wagon and just curl up on a piece of luggage and watch the world go by out the car window. You know? he's a little trooper. And he's settled in real well to his new home here and seems to be a perfectly happy little boy. So I was lucky with him. And not every cat I've had I would have won a drive 3,000 or 4,000 miles with. he's done it.
Yes, I can imagine. Some animals do not travel well.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I've got pictures of we'd stop, you know, for a beer at an outdoor cafe, bring him along on the leash, and he'd just sit on a ledge and watch the world going by. You know, he's just
okay. So we are out of time. Oh my gosh. Oh, I don't see Oberon. Where is he? Huh. Where's Oberon?
I don't know. He must
know
be having a moment.
Okay. Well,
they're usually in the chat room already.
That's right. But we continue on for a moment. Thank you, Phaedra, so much for being with us this evening. I really appreciate it.
Since Oz is not here yet, we should take opportunity to have a last couple of minutes. I called Phaedra earlier to make sure it was okay to bring this up on the show.
Okay.
So I was talking to Raven Caldera last week, and he was telling me Isaac came up in the topic, and so I heard that there is a group of people that are propitiating Isaac as an ancestor, and they are setting up all kinds of altars and things like that and doing spirit communication sessions with him and doing divination to get his 2 cents worth on what they're doing. And so I was curious what you thought about that, Phaedra.
Well, it's interesting. I certainly don't have any problem with anybody venerating an ancestor. Isaac and I both had spiritual ancestors on our ancestor altar.
So you and Isaac both practiced ancestor veneration.
Yes, we did. We definitely did. We had quite a elaborate ancestor altar in the wall of our old apartment. And one shelf of it, several shelves, and one shelf was for what we felt was our spiritual and intellectual ancestors. And we had a picture there of Elizabeth Levi and Alistair Coley and Gerald Gardner, and we had something from Dorian Domiente and things like that. So we were perfectly happy to do that. In terms of the divination and asking him, you know, for his advice and stuff, I really don't know what to think about that. I presume there'd be some sort of answer, but I really couldn't say if it was, you know, I just don't really know. I've never asked him direct questions like that, but, you know, if it's working for them and they're happy with it, and he may be liking the offering. So if you're offering to Isaac, I would highly, highly, highly recommend Irish whiskey and dark beer.
And I was just going to ask you that, so you already took the question right out of my head about what kind of offerings people should make.
Yes. Always Irish whiskey would be the first on the list. Mead, you know. You like things like that, so what the heck?
I gotcha. That's pretty cool. So what do you think he would think about this? Do you think he's reveling in it, if they are actually contacting him?
I think he might feel a little awkward about it. One thing that he never wanted to do was to be made out for being more than what he was. He used to say, you know, if you look at the old ADF documents, The rule number one is arch-druid fallibility. Rule number two is be rule number one. Rule number three is, no, I'm fallible, I mean it. he had feet of clay that went up to his waist, you know.
I gotcha. Yeah, I don't... We practice a lot of ancestor veneration stuff, you know, within our tradition, and I realize it is becoming more popularized. Don and I are actually writing a book on it. And, you know, I don't see my ancestors as being infallible. You know, I don't propitiate them in such a way. What I propitiate for them is for their forging the path.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I've mentioned many years ago, and it's starting to shift, is that something that was certainly missing from contemporary paganism was that ancestor aspect, that our white American paganism in the 80s and such didn't really have that ancestor veneration tradition. It really wasn't part of what we were doing. But because of the way that we've been exposed to a lot more of like the African diaspora tradition, Santeria, Budan and stuff, where ancestors are a big part of it, it's come in. And I think it's a very healthy thing. It actually is probably pulling us closer to the roots that we were, you know, liking to draw from.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's a good thing. My understanding of ancestor veneration wouldn't be so much for divination, it's so much as, like you said, opening the way of saying, you know, help me. You want me to be happy and successful, and, you know, you want your children to do well in the world, so can you please help me out with this thing that's blocking? That's the way Isaac and I would be more dealing with, because we both had at least a some background in more of a Santeria Ifá approach to it. So it would be more of that sense. Any kind of divination, I mean, I guess, you know, we do that in our ritual work to some extent, where we go and ask the nature spirits or the deities or what have you for help and guidance and stuff with such. But it would have never occurred to me to try to do a spirit divination necessarily with my ancestors.
Uh-huh.
I kind of kick it up a level. But,
right.
You know,
well, you know, and I think
somebody doesn't have to do something if it's working for them. It's just,
right.
It's interesting. It's interesting.
Well, it was interesting for me because I was always, like, really into genealogy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of propitiating my ancestors that way in keeping their names alive.
Mm-hmm.
Because I will, you know, I always tell stories about different people in my family because I think I had lots of awesome people in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through that, I mean, I always kind of like, yeah, ancestors are cool. But it wasn't until I did start practicing African diaspora that connection really clicked for me. Like you were saying,
mm-hmm.
that it's a lot of people are gaining it that way. And the,
mm-hmm.
the concepts that they discuss within the African diasporic, that the earth is actually made up of all the bones of all our people.
Mm-hmm.
So interestingly enough, and it's, you know, all those bones are mixed together from everybody,
yeah.
from so many different cultures.
Yeah, if you
and,
think about it.
Yeah, it's just, it's fantastic. And I think it's kind of awesome that, you know, people are talking to Isaac.
It's funny because the blogger, Teal Bishop, who's very interested in Druidry, and Isaac's work, did a whole blog about this just the other day about, you know, the deification of human beings and how he was very consistent about that in terms of his polytheism, that what if, you know, 1,000 years from now that he was on somebody's altar as a deity, and is that, like, right, or is that creepy, or is that messing with his head and what have you? And then you ask me about this. And it's kind of, wow, it's a real interesting question. I don't have a lot of easy answers for it. But as I say, again, there's as I just put it, the magical law of pragmatism.
Mm-hmm.
If it works, it's true. So
within African diaspora, what I will say is
mm-hmm.
that when we do divination to ask them a question or ask them for their assistance, we do keep it to very simple yes or no questions,
mm-hmm.
and not not about like real important life changing stuff.
What?
Mm-hmm.
So for that, you know, you would go to Ifá or, you know, whomever.
Right.
But it's all
right.
pretty interesting. I was just surprised that the person had brought it up and shared, not knowing that I knew you.
Yeah. Poor Isaac, you know, he was just a regular guy, and he was actually very sweet and could be very humble. But he lived large. He was present.
So when was Isaac's birthday?
October 1st, 1941.
Okay, so that way, those of you who want to propitiate Isaac as an ancestor, make sure you give him some birthday cake on the appropriate day.
You want to give him a shot. Give him whiskey.
Yep. Birthday cake and a shot.
Yes. Yes, he would like that very much, I think. I know that it's more important for him for his work to be remembered than for him to be remembered, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But if him being remembered makes the work be remembered, then there it goes.
Would be very true.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there will be a secret cult of Isaac in the future. But at least, you know, if he's being venerated, then perhaps the works of his life will be venerated right along with him.
Yeah, let's hope so. You know, who knows, in another couple of generations, you might have the equivalent of, Gardner said it, I believe it, and maybe it would be, Isaac said it, I believe it. I don't know. As long as they're getting something out of it, far be it for me to tell people they shouldn't be doing it. But it's a little startling, you know?
I think it's a little surprising, but I think it's kind of cool, too.
It is. It's funny because I've often had to muse over the fact that people that we really, you know, encounter at a celebrity level, and he used to refer to himself as a micro-celebrity. You know, in our little tiny world, he was a celebrity. We can go all fangirl or fanboy when we meet somebody, and God knows I've done it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a cool thing. But, you know, at home, he is just a guy, you know? He's a guy who sang silly songs while he did the dishes and you know, worried about, which one of us was going to clean the cat box and such. So, you know, it's always a little strange for the people closest to, a family member when you see things like that because, you knew him with the hat on and the hat off, as it were.
I think people often forget that, you know, our leaders in the pagan community wear a variety of different hats.
Right. We're just folk, you know. We got our ups and downs and good points and bad points. And, you know, we can be grumpy and out of sorts and silly about things and smart about things and all that stuff all wrapped together.
Yes, we have feet of clay and a variety of hats.
I often have to say that, you know, it's take people as their whole self, not just the parts of the people that you like. And
mm-hmm.
that goes separate for everybody in your life, you know. And sometimes people say, well, somebody's got, they can't hit, people have got to be perfect or they've got to fit a certain mold. If they've got one failing, then they have to throw out everything that person's done. And that doesn't always work that way, too. I mean,
right, it doesn't. Wow, there's a ringing phone. I don't know what that means.
All right. I'm here.
Oh, hello, Oberon. We're having extreme difficulty with the switchboard, so Phaedra and I are just chatting because none of us can access the switchboard.
Okay, well, please explain to our listeners what's going on so they won't...
Yeah, we are now... Thank you, Phaedra. Thank you that. We got everybody we were supposed to have.
Okay,
the
that's
opening
it for us tonight, everybody.
Good evening to you all. Have a lovely night.
Thanks,
okay.
Phaedra.
Welcome
tonight,
to the
everybody.
Magical world of Oberon and Ariel. Their continuing mission to explore strange new realms. To seek out new paradigms and new possibilities, to boldly go where no show has gone before. And now, over to Oberon and Ariel.
Good evening. I'm Oberon.
And I'm Ariel.
And this is our show.
Our show.
We're running a little late tonight, but we'll run a little over, so we should all be still give you a full hour.
We all had trouble getting in. It was a busy signal constantly, so I don't know if something's happening with the switchboard.
Yes,
but
they apparently had some serious trouble with the switchboard, so...
Yeah.
But now it's all okay, so here we are.
Well, in the interest of moving along here, I'm not going to do news of the day, and especially because there's really not a whole lot of good news, not anything interesting happened today that I could see.
All right. Well, then we'll just go right on in, and tonight's introduce our special guest, who is Stephen Emrys. And this is the pen name of a veteran journalist and educator who has written on subjects as diverse as history, religion, politics, and language. Stephen has served as an editor for fiction and nonfiction projects, and his first book, The Gospel of the Phoenix, was published in the summer of this year. This work, based on years of research into the political and pagan origins of Judeo-Christian thought, follows in the tradition of such writers as Calo Gibran and Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Jefferson Bible, or edited, and Robert Graves, who did King Jesus, really good book. Mm-hmm. This, The Gospel of the Phoenix examines the life of Jesus in biblical style through the lens of sources, including the canonical Gospels, the Jesus Sutras, the Gnostic Gospels, and the Egyptian Book of the Dead.
Stephen is the founder of the Facebook group Pagans of California and the Facebook page Pagan News Now. He has lectured occasionally on the pagan origins of Christianity and continues to research the development of religious traditions. He's worked as an editor, columnist, educator, and reporter, and serves as editor of the soon-to-be-published young adult novel Epidemic, the first installment of the upcoming Mad World series.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Stephen's personal belief is that the power of the collective unconscious, the all, or that which is the driving force behind the universe. How we interact with it and find our place within it determines our role in the grand scheme of things. The source lies within us, and we are an expression of that source. Our task is to cultivate our own awareness of this by acknowledging and seeking to understand ourselves and our surroundings. Stephen Emrys lives in California with his wife, stepson, one cat, and one dog. So welcome to the show, Stephen. It's great to have you with us.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you very much. I have to say I'm impressed with your opening. The debt that it pays to Gene Roddenberry and company, being a longtime Trekker myself, dating back about 40 years, and great admirer of that show.
Oh yes, so are we. I've always felt that the mission statement in that introduction is the best mission statement ever created. You know,
mm-hmm.
So we kind of adopted it a little bit to ourselves. I'm glad you appreciate it.
Yeah, I do. I'm a longtime Trekker and. Believe in a lot of what Gene Roddenberry thought about science and letting go of our preconceptions about things and exploring without any biases. That's just a great way to view the world.
Oh, well, I think so, too.
Mm-hmm. So, Stephen, what got you interested in the pagan origins of Christianity?
Well, I was actually... a Christian for some time back in my 20s. I'm in my late 40s now. And I became involved in a project which was a dream of mine to come up with a life of Jesus that was a comprehensive life of Jesus. And that included not only canonical sources, but also things outside of the Bible. And mm-hmm. I found myself at one point in time in a Bible bookstore and came across a book called The Lost Books of the Bible and the Forgotten Books of Eden. And I thought, well, what is this? And it turned out to be a collection of books from the early first century and previous to that and into the second century from different writers who wrote from a biblical perspective, but their books didn't end up being in the Bible when the canon was chosen, and these books included things like the first and second epistle of Clement, who was an early pope, was Doctor Saint Peter, and The Shepherd of Hermas, which was a Revelation type of book. And so that was my first exposure to that. And from there, I went on and looked up some other books. There are New Testament texts that didn't make it into the canon. And some of them come from a Gnostic point of view and from ultimately from a pagan perspective. They owe a lot to earlier mythologies. And, of course, that was not always looked fondly upon by the church of that day, which was looking to consolidate its power. And so that's where I got started with this. It's something that I wanted to do a long time ago. And with the advent of self-publishing, it's something that I decided, well, why not just put this thing together? And I started putting it together about a year ago, and decided I can just self-publish this thing and see if people will like it and will appreciate it. And so that's what I went ahead and did.
So how long have you been studying this area then? Like 20 years, or is that about right?
Probably about 25 years, because this was dating back to, I was involved in a fundamentalist church. Interestingly enough, I was brought up in an agnostic type of family, so I was encouraged to find my own path and was invited to this church. And actually, it was a good thing for me, because at the time I was very I wasn't very well socialized, and so it gave me a good outlet to become socialized. But it also, being a very inquisitive type person, opened my mind up to what else is out there other than what they're telling me. And I really wanted to find out what other things were about Jesus, anything I could about Jesus, because it seemed like a fascinating person to me, and I wanted to find out more about him.
Well, at what point did you depart from being able to be part of that church then? At some point that must have been a crisis of faith or something there.
Well, it was difficult for me to accept just the idea of, well, accept this on faith, and these people are telling me certain things that I don't necessarily believe in or aren't necessarily jibing with things that I'm reading on my own. And I wanted to be free to explore outside of doctrinal constraints, and beyond just the Bible, beyond just the person of Jesus, but I wanted to be able to find truth and acknowledge truth wherever I did find it. And so that kind of led me to to being somewhat at cross purposes with the folks in the church, because I was kind of pushing the envelope a bit, and I don't think they really appreciated it too much, and I basically felt a little too constrained by the doctrine that they were operating under. And this happened in my early 30s, and yet I still had the fascination for this subject matter, and I started exploring paganism and exploring other gods and mythological systems and backgrounds at that point, and found that a lot of these things are very close together. The Christian and Judeo-Christian thought owed a lot to earlier pagan thought, and I found that very intriguing, so I started looking into that.
Mm-hmm. So can you sum up the concept of your book, like in, you know, a brief sentence or two?
Concept of my book...
Go for it.
In a couple of sentences, it's to look at Jesus from a different perspective, to look at his life not from a doctrinal or dogmatic perspective, but from a perspective of what different sources might say about him, and can we, from these different sources, come up with a cohesive picture of who this person might have been. And it's not I don't present this to be a scripture. It's presented like a scripture in that style, but I don't present it to be an infallible document. What I present it to be is, and I consider the books of the Bible this as well, as I point out in my introduction, is that these are different people's perspectives on this person's life. And this is my perspective. And so that's the concept of the book.
So you've drawn your material then from these non-canonical gospels, texts, and Dead Sea Scrolls and things like that then?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, well, that's really fascinating. This is interesting. You know, we've been getting a number of these sorts of approaches. We had Mark Townsend on just a few weeks ago, who was talking about the his book, The Jesus Through Pagan Eyes. And it's very interesting that we're getting a pagan look at Christianity type of thing, or Jesus specifically, really. And, you know, we don't seem to have any problem with him among the pagans. You know, the problem is really more with his followers, not so much with what they believe, but their propensity to want to murder everybody they disagree with. So, you know,
right.
That's annoying. It's a little hard to work with that, you know.
that's the problem I have with Christianity, or mainstream Christianity, I should say. And I want to make a distinction between that and say, for example, Gnostic Christianity and some of the more open Christian systems that do accept other beliefs. And I think that opens up room for a dialogue between and among different faiths and different systems. But I have a problem with the us versus them mentality that many mainstream and conservative Christians operate under. And it makes it very hard to say, okay, well, let's have a dialogue about this. Let me listen to you and you can listen to me, when they don't really want to listen to me.
Yeah, that's always a problem. You know, I think the crucial issue really comes down to the precepts of monotheism. You know, which is built into it, this whole idea of the one true right and only way, and so that simply doesn't leave any room for a dialogue with any other perspective. There any other perspective is just going to be a priori flat out wrong. You know, and more than just wrong. I mean, that's not really so much the issue. It's that they seem to consider alternative perspectives to be evil and must be eradicated, you know, and doesn't leave
right.
a lot of room for that, you know. I'm
yeah,
sure
and
you
that
run into some of this.
That I've run into a lot of it, and it's what caused me to kind of break with the church ultimately, was this idea that they have the right way, and not only are people who deviate from that way incorrect, but they're bound for eternal damnation, and they are to be shunned, and they are to be looked upon as less than other people. And I'm a very egalitarian person. I believe very strongly in equality for all people. And so that makes it difficult. It's interesting that you bring that up, because that's actually the premise for my second book, which just came out today.
Really?
On Amazon, yeah. It's called Requiem for a Phantom God, and it's basically an indictment of monotheism. And it's another project I had brewing for some time, and once I finished the Gospel of the Phoenix, one day I started sitting down and writing, and I thought, this could be a book. And so within a month, I put this thing out, and it just came out on Amazon today. And I'm pretty happy with that, too, although it's an entirely different kind of work than the Gospel of Phoenix.
Wow. Well, let's get back to that one after the break. We need to take a little break right now, and then we can talk about the Requiem for a Phantom of God. That sounds fascinating. So we invite our listeners to call in with comments or questions. And right after the break, the number here is 347-308-8222.
Water shared is life shared. Founded by Oberon Zell in 1962, the Church of All Worlds is one of the oldest neo-pagan religions and the first to claim the identity of pagan. Inspired by Heinlein's sci-fi novel, Stranger in a Strange Land, CAW has been a major influence in the emergence of modern paganism. Originating the ritual of water sharing, CAW was the first church to legally ordain women as priestesses and to sanction gay and poly marriages. Thou art goddess, enter the nest at www.caw.org.
Before the internet, there was Green Egg, founded in 1968 by Oberon Zell. For over 40 years, Green Egg has been the leading journal of the emerging pagan movement. garnering numerous awards and worldwide recognition for its journal arts, articles, and its controversial forum. Green Egg is now online as a beautiful full-color e-zine, edited by Ariel Montserrat and designed by Tom Donahue. Moreover, it's free. Collect back issues and subscribe at www.greeneggzine.com because legends never die.
So choose, make a life in California. But your dreams and all your hopes are ripped away. Where have you gone?
This is Oberon, and we're back here on Over to Oberon and Ariel. We are talking with Stephen Emrys about his first book, The Gospel of the Phoenix, on the pagan origins of Christianity. And, Stephen, what authors and books have influenced you?
Oh, well, it's a long list of folks. You mentioned Jesus as being viewed as a possibly a pagan figure. One of the authors that I have read that went into some of the research behind another work that that is coming out in the future of mine is a guy named Morton Smith, who has a book out that's now out of print called Jesus the Magician, which I thought was fascinating. It looks at Jesus from the point of view of being a magician and performing magical acts, which there are several in the Gospels. There's an author who I think is fascinating look at James, the brother of Jesus, by the name of Robert Eisenman. He's a professor at Long Beach State, or was last time I heard of him. And it's about an 800-page book that explores the movement that was founded by James, the brother of Jesus, who was the first head of the Christian church. Many people think that Peter was, but actually James, the brother of Jesus, was. So those are a couple of many. I think in the book that I have that was the impetus for the Gospel of the Phoenix, but it hasn't been published yet. I have about 200 different sources for that book. And when that comes out sometime next year, that's a much more scholarly look at this same concept.
Wow, you're really on a roll with your writing. I wanted to just say let the audience know what the song was, which
yes.
It was called Katrina's Song, and it's a song. It's by Gwen Squires, and it is in honor of Katrina Kessler, who did the Young Witches of Salem movie. She just died recently, apparently.
That's a very pretty selection. I really like that. I enjoy listening to that.
Pretty. So, what is the most interesting idea in your book?
Well, the most interesting idea, there are some that will be familiar to people. One will be the fact that that I believe, along with Dan Brown, the author of The Da Vinci Code, and many other people who have looked at this in a more scholarly fashion, that Jesus was in fact married, and that he was married to Mary Magdalene, and there's good evidence to support that. I think probably the most jarring thing to some people will be the idea that Jesus was involved in Egyptian mysticism and in the cult of Osiris, and that Osiris may have been his heavenly father, and that may be the god to whom he was referring to as his heavenly father. That he had some sort of syncretism going on between the Egyptian mystery religion of Osiris, which was very popular back in that day. In fact, Isis, the goddess, and Osiris's consort, was among the most popular figures in that day in the Roman Empire. And there was some syncretism between Osiris and Yahweh, and that Jesus was performing somewhat of a marriage of these two concepts.
Well, that's interesting because we know that the early images of the Madonna were just, I mean, the figures and statues and iconography and everything else were just images of Isis and Horus in the Roman style, which was popular at that time. We tend to think of the Egyptian style, but she was enormously popular throughout the Roman Empire at that time. And she was depicted with the baby exactly the same. In fact, the name on the inscribed on the things, Isis, is spelled exactly the same as Jesus, you know.
Yeah. That's another book that I read that you reminded me of. I believe it's called The Black Madonna, and it talks about these Black Madonna figurines that were found not just in Egypt, as you said, but throughout Europe. And they thought that initially when they found these, that these were figures of the Madonna and Child being Mary and Jesus, and they found out later that in fact they were not, but they were figures of Isis and Horus. I like to joke around when I'm driving around at Christmas time and drive by a creche or a nativity scene to say, oh, there's Osiris and Horus and Isis. And another fascinating thing is that Isis's name, one of Isis's names was in Egyptian Mary, M-E-R-I. So, and she was called also the Queen of Heaven, as was Mary in the Mother of Jesus. So there are a lot of lot of crossovers in the mythology there.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, indeed. So, well, what's your personal spiritual path and philosophy? Describe that.
I would say I'm closest to I'm a combination of a pantheist and a freethinker. I believe that we need to be open, or I need to be open personally, to whatever possibility might present itself. I'm a finite being, and I can't know everything. But I do believe that the divine, whether you call it God or Gaia or however you want to express that, or the Lord and Lady, is all present in all things. And so I'm very, very much a pantheist in that sense. But I also believe very strongly in science, and I can't wait to find out. I'm kind of like Carl Sagan and the wonders of the universe. What is the universe going to show us next? And I think it's just fascinating to find that out when we do.
Yeah, that's sort of thing is one of those areas that I find so common in the pagan community, is that you get a bunch of us together and it only takes a few minutes before we're all starting to talk about, you know, particle physics and quantum theory and stuff like that. And yeah, these conversations probably don't occur in very many other churches, you know.
No, I don't think they do.
But they really are common in ours, and I think that's fascinating. You have to really kind of study this stuff just to be able to keep up with the conversations.
and I don't claim to be a physicist. I've seen things like Down the Rabbit Hole, the movie that was out a few years ago. What the Bleep Do We Know? And I found that fascinating. But I am not a scientist. In fact, my wife will, when I come up with some science fiction type things, will call me bad science. You're on the verge of being bad science boy here, and so I admit mm-hmm. to a certain degree of innocence regarding that, I guess I should say.
Well, you know, I mean, an awful lot of interesting ideas were certainly put out through Star Trek, especially during the Next Generation era, and what the hell, you know? I mean, crazy ideas are being put out there all the time, you know, stuff that people are just making stuff up half the time, and this gets treated seriously. Things like string theory and dark energy and things that, you know, trying to figure out ways to explain stuff, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what's going on. It's a constant process, you know.
Exactly, and I think that's what you point out with the process, a difference between the pagan community and the monotheist community, is I think people in the pagan community recognize it's a process, and that we don't write something in stone and say this is the end of all revelation. But we're constantly looking to update ourselves, and that's very much of a scientific type of a perspective. Whereas people in the monotheist community, and I don't just mean Christians, but people who are involved in the dogma that says this is the be-all and end-all of our revelation and nothing can be added to this, as it says in the last book of Revelation, I think that's very limiting, and that's something that I couldn't continue to subscribe to within the Christian church, and that's part of what I address in my other book, The Requiem for a Phantom God. And in fact, a quote from Gene Roddenberry is on the last page of that book. It's a says, we must question the story logic of having an all-knowing, all-powerful God who creates faulty humans and then blames them for his own mistakes.
Right. Yeah, well, some of those episodes really nail that stuff pretty intensely. I remember there was you know, one about who mourns for Apollo, I think it was, or was it Adonis? I forget now. But
Adonis,
it was all about that. Adonis, right. Well, why don't we talk a little about your latest book then, since we're leading into it, The Requiem for a Phantom God. It just came out on Amazon, and you said it's an indictment of monotheism. So let's talk about that.
Well, it is. I boil it down to two basic points in my last chapter. It's a couple hundred pages long, but one of the points is that I believe that we have to make a choice between an immanent God and a transcendent God. Do we want a God who is a God of everything, or a divine system, if you will, whether you call it God or the universe or however you want to label it, Or do we want to follow a God who is looking after our own interests and simply going to back us up for whatever opinion we might have? And I don't believe those two concepts really go together. I don't think you can have both. You can't have somebody who's on your side and someone who is basically a creator of all things, and you get into problems of good and evil, and what constitutes those concepts. And then the second concept that I address is I believe that our gods, if we choose to believe in them, must be forced to live up to our ethics, or even to ethics that are superior or surpass our own human standards. And I, part of the problem I have with monotheism is that many of the deeds that are not only condoned but ordered by the gods of monotheism are things that would get somebody thrown into jail nowadays, or brought before a UN tribunal for war crimes. And I think to myself, do I want to follow a god like that can't even live up to my own ethical standards? And I really don't.
I think that's a crucial point, and one that really, at some point when you face these kind of things, these, you know, ordering the slaughters of the innocents and the countless horrific examples really throughout the Old Testament in particular, you know, you really have to question this thing. I mean, you know, even if you believe that this God ruled the universe, would you want to follow it? You would have to oppose it. You would have to be, you know, join the opposition, you know, because it does not have a moral standard that we would want to promote, you know?
Right.
So, Stefan, how do you see paganism and Christianity fitting together?
Well, I think they can fit in together if we look at the message of Jesus rather than glorifying the person of Jesus. And this is where I think Christianity kind of went off the rails, so to speak, in terms of mainstream dogma, is they became so concerned with, let's just glorify this person and worship this person. And it's interesting because I heard Phaedra Bonewits talk about some people who do this with Isaac Bonewits on the previous show leading into this, and that he said, I'm not infallible, I'm just a guy. And she was reiterating, and I'm saying to myself, yes, that's exactly the case. We tend to want to glorify these people who did great things and thought great thoughts, but they themselves were just people. And the minute we start to focus on the person rather than the message, I think we become in danger of losing the message. And I think that's what happened to Christianity. I think when Christianity focuses on much of the message of Jesus, and I'm not one who agrees with everything that was attributed to Jesus. In fact, there have been books, the Jesus Seminar produced a book that ranked different sayings of Jesus as to how likely they thought they were as being authentic sayings of Jesus. A lot of this stuff we don't know whether Jesus said it or not, or whether followers said it in his name. But what I can say is that there is a core teaching of morality and of ethics within Jesus' teaching, some of which is very pantheistic in thought, if you look at the Gospel of Thomas, for example, and much of which is very ethical and reflects my own ethical standards. And in fact, that's why I was drawn to Christianity in the beginning, was the ethic of it, not worshiping somebody or getting a what I call a get-out-of-hell-free card. That's not my motivation. It wasn't then. And
the problem was he you know, for all of the great ideas and vision and stuff and his mission and all that stuff, he seemed to have really believed that there wasn't going to be any need to write any of his stuff down, that somehow this would, the people he was talking to, that was going to be the last generation somehow. And apparently he really believed that, because he didn't write anything down and record it for posterity. And so all we have is the words of people writing down what they think they remember he said decades later. I mean, the earliest things were written like 30 years afterwards. And I don't know about you, but I'd have a hard time quoting word for word a conversation I had yesterday, let alone 30 years ago, you know?
That's an excellent point. That's another point I make in my book as well. Is that it's this sort of stuff, if we were to put this stuff on trial in the modern court, none of this would be acceptable as evidence. It would be too far in the past. We'd have statute of limitations. We'd have, questions of hearsay and this sort of stuff. And it just would not be the kind of evidence that we would accept as this is evidence of something you're going to base your whole life on.
It is amazing that people do. Well, it's time now to take another little break, and then we'll be back, and we will talk some more with Stephen about his Gospel of the Phoenix and Requiem for a Phantom God. And we invite our listeners to call in with comments or questions. This is a participatory show. The number here is 347-308-8222.
Learn real magic from the pros. Get your magical training at our online Academy of Arcana. Receive personalized instruction from a faculty of 30 renowned authors, teachers, and practitioners representing a spectrum of magical arts and traditions. Oberon Zell's Gray School of Wizardry offers 375 classes in 16 departments for adults and youth ages 11 and up. The school includes clubs, forums, competitions, and other social activities, including summer campouts. Graduates are certified as journeyman wizards. Check out this unique school and enroll at www.grayschool.com.
Coming this Sunday night is Pagan Science Radio joining in the Pagan Tonight crew. 10 o'clock Sunday night, Pagan Science Radio.
Sacred art for your magical life. Mythic Images is dedicated to the rebirth of mythology and the awakening of Gaia. We invite you to explore our collection of pagan and goddess-oriented images, including Oberon's famous millennial Gaia. Oberon and Morning Glory Zell create museum-quality replicas, devotional statuary, books, posters, and magical jewelry for Wicca, pagan, and all nature-based religions. Explore the Mythic Images catalog at www.mythicimages.com.
All right, this is Oberon, and we're back here on Over to Oberon and Ariel, and we're talking with Stephen Imrys about his books, The Gospel of the Phoenix on the Pagan Origins of Christianity, and his Requiem for a Phantom God. It's an indictment of monotheism. So before we go back into the thing, though, Stephen, there was something that you mentioned that just really kind of just threw me. You said that Phaedra had said something about that Isaac is being regarded as somehow a source of what word could we say here? Infallibility and wisdom. I think that is so astonishing. He must be, spinning in his grave and laughing his ass off.
I think so, and I'm not sure if she said that other people were saying that, but she made a point to say he was not infallible, as though some people had come up to her and with the idea that because he was such a well-respected person in the community that he was not a person. And she made a reference to his normal life where she and he would discuss who would clean out the cat box. And I thought, well, that's just wonderful. That's a great image.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, it's wildly amusing that anybody could possibly think otherwise of any of us, really. And I suppose, I guess if you get far enough removed, some aura of infallibility grows around one, which is probably, as you obviously, the example you're meaning, what happened to poor Jesus, Because I'm sure in real life that was hardly the case.
Yeah. I need to interrupt here. We've got a caller. And
great. All right.
Yes. And I'd like to welcome Daniel. Daniel, are you there?
Yes, I am here. And hello, and thank you, everyone, for having me this evening.
Hi, Daniel. All right.
I like this topic a lot, and I think the author, when I get my next paycheck this Thursday, I may buy a copy of his book, so be sure to put the information out there.
Great.
Awesome.
One thing that I think is interesting, and Oberon said this earlier, and I'll sort of make my point and then just sort of let you guys discuss, is when he said, of course, I don't have any problem with the actual Christ or Jesus himself, but more so some of his followers or misrepresentative followers, and it brings me to lots of points, but I'm going to focus on one, is how they view, this is something you hear a lot in the modern day right now with political issues and such, is how they view homosexuality, which is they keep saying, oh, the Bible says it's against it. And in some ways, they're sort of right. But if you look at the etymological history of translating it from Greek to English, the word that was used in some of the verses that they talk about, one was arsenikoitos and the other one was malikos. And these words translate not into homosexual love, but they speak to abuse or subjugation, slavery, treatment of slaves, or maybe just behavior unbefitting a temple, like temple prostitutes or something of that nature. So what happens is people, I won't say all, but some of the fundamentalist Christians I know sort of lose a scholarly sense. Like, they don't want to research anything. They just kind of like showing up and being told something instead of going, oh, I want to dig in. They'll dig into a degree to whatever such person or hero, back to another point you guys were making earlier. This is how you know I was listening. when they were saying, do not just be about the person, but be about the belief system. And I think Phaedra Bonowitz had mentioned that earlier of, you know, Isaac isn't perfect. No man is perfect. No woman is perfect. But doing some research, and again, I've always been fascinated by the early classical, what some people might call a classical education, could be actually called a pagan education. And if you start translating the Bible and seeing that it comes from different languages and that it wasn't written by the man you go see singing a song on Sunday, you see that some of these words don't exactly translate as they had thought, or as they do think now. I mean, again, I was using the examples of arsenikoitos and malikos, not meaning that it's against homosexual love, but bad or abusive behavior.
Fair enough. And, all of that kind of stuff, in any case, is way back in the Old Testament, buried along with all sorts of capital crimes for things that we wouldn't even consider a problem these days. Like, if your kid talks back to you, you should stone him to death, things like that. And, mm-hmm. you know, can't cut your hair and all kinds of weird stuff. And none of that is in the teachings of Jesus. He didn't have a word to say about this. He didn't say anything about people being gay. He didn't define who's allowed to get married. He didn't tell you couldn't smoke the weeds, you know. I mean, there's none of that there. And people who attribute this stuff to the Bible, the only references to marriage in the Bible that define it, in fact, promote polygamy as the model. So, you know, how do these people get off thinking that the Bible is somehow promoting their particularly weird morality? I don't understand. So what would you say about all that stuff, Stephen?
Well, I think that the reason people gravitate toward this sort of thing is that it's a known, and it reinforces what they believe. It's a lot more difficult to deal with situations as they come along than it is to say, oh, this is what this Scripture says about it. I'll plug this into my belief system and use that as my standard. Jesus, for example, one of my favorite quotations attributed to him is that the Sabbath is made for man. Man is not made for the Sabbath. These right. rules, whatever they are to be applied according in the context with which you find yourself in your daily life. They're not some sort of absolute chiseled in stone type of thing that you apply without thinking about them. This is, I think, what a lot of people who are involved in fundamentalist religions want. They want somebody to say, this is the way you always handle these situations, no matter what situation you find yourself in, do this.
Yeah. Mm. One size fits all. And then they don't have to figure out, you know, The little gray areas there of morality.
Exactly.
Yeah, they forget that your mileage may vary.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Some of them are definitely, don't try this at home.
Yeah. So, Stephen, who do you hope buys your book?
I hope people who have an open mind buy my book more than anybody else. I'm not trying to shove anything down anybody's throat here. I don't want to start a religious war. I want to make it clear that I have the utmost respect for the person of Jesus, but that there is a way to think things through and come to your own conclusions without being spoon-fed something, as was mentioned earlier on a Sunday morning. And to understand these things in the context in which they were written, and they're not necessarily the context that we find ourselves today. We have all these other things that have happened in the last 2,000 years that may make some of these things irrelevant. There are different kinds of things in the Bible. One that was mentioned about homosexuality, for example, within that culture, it was unacceptable. I'm a very, as I said, egalitarian person, and I believe that as we evolve as a people and as a culture, and as human beings, we come to become more accepting of different ways of doing things and different ways of showing love. So I'm very much for the LGBT movement and for recognizing the equality that exists in all people.
Well, most pagans seem to feel a good affinity with the line from the Charge of the Goddess that Doreen Valiente wrote: "All acts of love and pleasure are my rituals." And you know, and that means that we get all the gays, which I think is wonderful, because you know that means we have the best artists and the best musicians and the best interior decorators, and the Christian fundamentalists, they can't have them. You know, if you don't
yeah,
like
absolutely.
It, you can't have it.
Bring them all over here.
Yeah,
well,
we want.
The
we
simple,
want. You know?
The simple idea of diversity. This way, we have a wide range of diverse opinions, and it all goes into paganism, and I think keeps us open-minded and always wanting to learn from each other's differences.
Yep. I like it that way.
Yeah.
So
it's something I miss here in Tennessee. It's pretty, we don't have that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're pretty bleak there, the armpit of the Bible Belt, whatever. I don't know the right term. Buckle seems a little bit too fancy for what you got there.
The armpit?
Well, I don't know. That doesn't really work either. I'm not sure what part you'd say.
Well, I'm from the Central Valley of California, which is supposedly has the largest concentrations of Christian churches west of the Mississippi.
Really?
And I don't live there anymore, which I'm kind of thankful for, since it's burning up hot there. It's like 110 degrees over there right now, and I'm over here on the coast and loving the weather over here and loving the more open attitude that people tend to have over here too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Where do you live, Stephen?
I live on the Central Coast, in
Central
San Luis Obispo area.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
In where now?
San Luis Obispo. It's a small town.
Oh.
It's near Mo Beach.
In that area.
Yeah.
That's a nice area there. Yeah.
Huh?
It's pretty.
Yeah, it's just gorgeous. I love this place.
So, Stephen, what's your background as a writer?
Well, my background is I've been, and as I think you mentioned, this is a pen name that I use because it's a separate thing for me. It's a separate aspect of my life that I'm opening up. And I am a veteran journalist. I've been a journalist for 26 years. I've worked at daily newspapers. I've worked in the classroom with... I've been a part-time substitute teacher, and I just wanted to write all my life. Ever since I was in 11th grade, I had a creative writing class and wrote, and I got into journalism with the idea of being a writer, and I ended up instead becoming an editor and losing some of the dream that I had, and just lately I've found that again. I'm married to a wonderful woman who is also a writer, and so we support each other in our writing, and this is why I've been able to start actually kicking books out that have been germinating in my mind for the last 20 or 30 years.
Wow.
All right. Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about some of your other projects, and you've got, can you want to tell us a little bit about the book that came out today?
Yeah, the book that came out today is called Requiem for a Phantom God. And by the way, I'm going to be at, for those of you in California, I'm going to be at San Diego Pagan Pride. My wife and I are going to be there with our books and signing our books. And I'm also going to be giving a presentation on the pagan origins of Christianity, which I've given at various places before. And
any plans to come up to Pantheacon?
I have been wanting to do that for the past probably 10 years, and it always comes around where I either can't afford it or I have to work or something like that. And so I'm very interested in doing that at some point. I'm going to do it at some point, but I haven't yet.
Well, yeah, I hope you do, because I think that it would be great for you to present workshops on this topic and stuff. This is obviously becoming a really fascinating issue. I think a lot of pagans who've, I mean, the vast majority of us came from Christian backgrounds and families. You know, we didn't, you know, back in the early days, there wasn't any pagan community for us to come from, you know, or families to come from. Mm-hmm. So we started there. And, you know, any possibility of redeeming something out of this, you know, somehow salvaging the baby from the bathwater is something that I think appeals to a lot of us to try to look at that stuff. There must be something good in there, you know. Somewhere here there's a pony, you know.
Yeah. I think there is. And this is, you know, this is kind of, I wasn't willing to, when I left the church, say, you know, everything about this is bad. And I think this is part of the, again, the mentality of pagans, of learning things and the scientific method of not just saying, oh, there's, the world is black and white, and we throw out everything over on this side of the line and keep everything on that side of the line. But in fact, we judge everything on its own merits according to our own ethics and our own conscience, and our own wisdom. And that is what attracted me to paganism in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what's your next project?
Well, I have a few. I'm working on a prequel to the Gospel of the Phoenix, which is an Old Testament version from a pagan perspective. And that's about, it's about half done, maybe a little bit more than half. I also have what I call my magnum opus, which is the scholarly work that led into the Gospel of the Phoenix, and I ended up publishing the Gospel of the Phoenix first. But that's about a 600-page work on this topic of the pagan origins of Christianity. And so I'm really interested in doing that. That'll come out within the next year. And I've also got an idea for a novel, which is that incorporates gods and science fiction. And I hope, if I can pull it off, will be similar in tone to Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman.
That's definitely something to work for. Well, you're also doing this a young adult series, this Mad World series. Can you tell us something about that?
Oh, that's my wife's. She just started, and I'm in the midst of editing her second book. She's writing it, and I'm editing it. First book is called Epidemic. It's a series of Mad World, and it's designed to be at least a trilogy. And the second book is, I think, much better than the first one. I'm getting a lot of good feedback on the first. It's about zombies. But it's not from your typical point of view. It's from the point of view that people become zombies because they've reawakened the Black Plague, and that this plague has spread and is causing all sorts of havoc. And it follows this group of teenagers who grow up during the series of novels as they try to avoid the Black Plague and avoid being infected by it, and have a series of adventures across the country, and it's really quite interesting. It's not a genre that would be something that I would gravitate toward naturally, but she writes it really well and writes it in such a way that you're constantly going. She doesn't leave any room for you to catch your breath, but it's a very easy read and a very fun read.
All right. Well, that sounds like fun. Well, we're winding up our time here, but before we go, do you have a website that promotes your material, your books, projects, something you can tell our listeners about?
Well, I have several websites. On Facebook, I'm Stephen Emrys, and that's Stifyn is the first name, and Emrys is the last name, Emrys, which was the name of Merlin, means immortal, and that's why I chose it. I just thought it sounded kind of cool. And so that's on Facebook, and it's the same name on Twitter. I have people will follow me, can follow me on Twitter at Stephen Emrys. And I also have a website that's a Webs website that is just my name again, .webs.com, .webs.com. And there you can find reviews of my books. And go on Amazon. They're available on Amazon. They're available on CreateSpace. And you can see what you think of them.
That's great. And that's The Gospel of the Phoenix. And the other book is Requiem for a Phantom God. So you can look those up on Amazon and then send any reviews to Amazon to do it. Mm-hmm. Well, there we go. And this has been really fun. Thanks for being our guest tonight, Stephen. It was great having you on the show.
Well, I sure enjoyed it, and I really appreciate the opportunity. I enjoyed talking to you both.
Yeah, it was
right.
Nice to talk to you, Steve. And I'd like to thank our beloved web mistress for bringing your book and you to my attention.
Okay. Definitely. She's a good friend of mine on Facebook and a great person.
She
oh,
is.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, this is great. And certainly these have been fascinating conversations on this whole pagan connection with Christianity. I think that there's a lot of places to go with this, and I'm sure we'll find more to do. So, Ariel, who do we have lined up for next week's show?
Next week's show, we have Miguel Sage, who is indigenous Taino shaman, who has been working for decades with other Mayan shamans, about what will be happening for 2012. And he's a fascinating person. And he'll be with us next Wednesday.
That'll be great. Yeah, he and I just collaborated on a major piece of writing for an e-book that's being put out by Harvey Wasserman. So we'll be able to say some more about that, too.
Excellent.
And that'll be a lot of fun. So that's our show for tonight. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday, same pagan time, same pagan station. And then check out Stephen's website and his books on Amazon.com. So, merry meet.
And merry part.
And merry meet again.
Again. Good night, Tom and Aubrey.
Good night.
Pagans Tonight Radio Network is a nightly podcast on Blog Talk Radio with a variety of shows. Explore news, information, entertainment, and ideas from a pagan point of view around the globe. Join us on Crystal Web Mondays with Ed and Marianne, exploring where crystals crash and psychic powers converge. Followed by Mark Mandrake and Blue Firewitch covering the mystic and pagan world on the path less traveled. On Tuesdays, Surf Crash Study with Selena Fox, followed by Pagan Priest, a panel show with priests from around the nation talking about men's spirituality. On Wild Wednesdays, Where Anything Goes with Ed the Pagan and me, Tracy Logan Wood, followed by Over to Oberon featuring Grayskull's headmaster, wizard, Oberon Zell Ravenheart, and Green Egg Editrix, Ariel Montserrat. On Karelian Thursdays with Terry Power, discussing the nature of the divine, followed by the pagan pundit, Reverend Don Lewis, the chancellor of the Karelian tradition. On Friday, Pagan Priestess, another panel show featuring priestesses from a variety of backgrounds, philosophies, and traditions. On Saturday, Pagans Tonight in Espanol, led by Reverend Lamatic and Yoko, followed by Circle's Pagan Warrior Radio, a show that supports military pagans, friends, and family. On Sunday, Variety Show with Liz Hamilton, followed by the new show, Pagan Science Radio. Please visit us at www.pagans.com to see show schedules for all shows or friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Pagans Tonight is sponsored in part by WSI International, your online source for pagan, Wiccan, and magical education. Thank you for joining us on WSI-sponsored Pagans Tonight Radio Network. You can hear us every night right here on Blog Talk Radio or download us later on iTunes. Please check our schedule for accurate show times. For all questions, comments, or show suggestions, you can email us at pagans tonight@gmail.com and let us know how we're doing. We'd love to hear from you. You can also visit us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on LiveJournal. We invite you to tune in again tomorrow night. Good night, and blessed be.